Hey, welcome everyone to our session entitled Transforming Teacher Education to Shape a Just Sustainable Future. My name is Elizabeth Crawford, and I am a professor of elementary education at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. This is my seventh year participating in the SDG 4 seminar at the University of UVascula. And I'm also, in addition to my role at the university, I'm currently involved in various international development research projects and Indonesia, Timor-Leste, and Madagascar. I am a former classroom teacher. I have taught English in France, and I've also taught kindergarten and upper primary school in the US. And it's my pleasure to introduce Carla.
Yep. Hi, everyone there, both online and in person. So yes, my name's Carla. I'm currently the director at the Dresden International School, so not too far from Finland. I've been in international education for pretty much my whole teaching career. I am American, but I left very young, came overseas and worked in Germany, Switzerland, Hong Kong. And recently I was in Singapore for 7 years at the United World College there. And I'm the co-author of two books. The first one is called Concept-Based Inquiry and Action. It's all about how we can help students move from more concrete levels of thinking to more abstract conceptual levels of thinking to promote criticality, creativity in the thinking process. And the other is Worldwise Learning, which I co-authored with Elizabeth. And that's going to be the focus of our talk today about teacher education, about how we can really give students in the classroom lots of thinking opportunities to understand issues that matter to them.
So in terms of our agenda today, we're going to explore what it means to prepare educators in the world in which we live today that's increasingly complex and includes shared challenges. We will then highlight different ways or opportunities for enhancing teachers' critical content and pedagogical knowledge as it relates to ESD. And then we will actively practice some strategies from Worldwise Learning, the book that Carla just mentioned, to nurture connection, understanding, and action in teachers and students. So I wanted to begin with a story. I noticed your lovely house space included so many historical photographs over the past 160 years from the University of UVascula, which I really enjoyed exploring. So I wanted to share my own photograph and story. This is my father's father, my grandfather, who was an educator, a principal, superintendent in South Georgia in the United States. This photograph was taken 1 year before my father was born in 1945. And I think about how much the world has truly changed since my grandfather worked in education in 1945. In particular, the volume of knowledge that we have globally at that time doubled just every 25 years. Today, it is every 12 hours. So just imagine how this will shape how we live, how we work, and how we prepare for the future. So in the chat, and we're with each other in the classroom, turn and talk to a partner about what do you think the implications are of our rapidly changing knowledge economy, in particular on teaching and learning. So we'll take just a moment to share what our thoughts are about how our world has changed in just two generations and how this will impact how we prepare teachers and how we teach students. So take a moment and then we'll share a few ideas. And those of you who are online, please use the chat. My grandfather died when I was 8 years old, and I still remember him, but I didn't know him when he was well. So I love to look at old photographs of him.
Yeah.
Okay, would we like to share a few ways that we think this rapidly changing knowledge economy will change how we teach and learn? Oh, good. Hi. This will be great if they have a wireless mic, they can walk around and we can hear the participants.
Yes, we're trying to currently set up the mic right now.
Shall we go on or shall we share a few? I think maybe we have one or two examples.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So, one of the implications that we discussed with not for us, I guess. Yeah. So, what was I saying? Yeah. So one of the implications that we and my partner discussed is with the rapidly changing knowledge economy, it's hard to vet the quality of information that we are getting. Mm-hmm. And it's also that everybody has their own platform and it's amplified to a level that was not available previously. Everybody has an opinion, and who is moderating that? And also the question of the sources of information we have online. Most of us, I suppose, are familiar with the issue about misinformation and disinformation and how these are affecting behaviors such as voting behaviors, for example. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So stuff like this, I think, is a byproduct of how quick and how much information is out there.
Thank you so much. Absolutely. And this is changing very rapidly with AI, as if any of you all are teaching in the classroom now, you know, especially with students.
Yeah, so is this on?
Yes.
Along the same line of thought, I would maybe challenge a little bit the wording. So maybe instead of knowledge, I would speak about content or bytes or something, because knowledge doesn't double in every 12 hours, but perhaps the content of or the amount of cat videos or whatever may double. which make it increasingly hard to separate like what is worthwhile.
Absolutely. And that was going to be my next comment about the debate around how this is calculated and defined, which is not my area of expertise, but that's an absolutely valid point about what do we mean by content or knowledge. But I think we can all agree that the world is changing very quickly, and especially the vast amount of information or mis or disinformation that's readily available is shaping how we teach and learn. other forces at play here, of course, just in the last couple of years, a global pandemic, geopolitical conflicts, rising inflation, the devastating effects of climate change that are happening more rapidly than they predicted. And then, of course, AI is related to what we were just speaking about, how it's going to impact every sector and every aspect of our lives, and also presented a threat to democracy. These are articles just from the last week online. So these interconnected issues call for us to have a new vision for how we teach, and that's sort of the premise of our book and how we prepare and support teachers.
So when we look at the Sustainable Development Goals, obviously SDG 4 is quality education. It is the focus of the seminar that you're currently attending. And if we drill down into the targets, we can see that target 4.7 specifically talks about education for sustainable development and sustainable lifestyles. And then the question we need to ask is, if all learners need to have access to education for sustainable development and sustainable lifestyles, what does that mean for our curricula, for teacher education, for student assessments, for pathways between the primary, secondary school environment and into tertiary education? And so we can see how there are so many implications and complexities kind of built into this target, and we're going to be exploring some of those today.
So ESD has, in teacher education particularly, has a long history. It emerged out of the mid-20th century. Its roots are in environmental education. But progress, even though that was many decades ago, has been very slow in bringing this to the forefront. For example, in the 2016 GEM report, they reported that only 8% of the country surveyed integrated sustainable development in teacher education. So only 8%. So due to this, many call for a reorientation of teacher education systems towards sustainability. So not just a matter of integrating content, but a whole systems approach to incorporating ESD in teacher education. There have been many initiatives throughout the years. The UN Decade of Education for Sustainable Development called, as Carla mentioned, for ESD to be integrated at all systems, all education systems levels. So in response, many countries have developed policies and frameworks to integrate sustainability concepts into their teacher education curricula and their teacher training. Teacher education institutions like mine began revising their programs to include modules or content focused on ESD over the years so that they can equip teachers to have the knowledge and the skills and the pedagogical approaches needed to teach about sustainability across different subject areas and across different grade levels. Recently, the European Commission published a report outlining the past 30 years of research in Europe, European case studies in teacher education, because they wanted to inform policymaking. And their findings indicate that teachers want to teach about sustainability, but they don't know how to do it. It's not yet a curriculum priority. And the report highlighted that the findings across the case studies that having relevant content, using active and participatory learning, collaboration, mentoring, and building a community of expertise is effective for embedding sustainability across all levels. And then lastly, I wanted to reference this guidebook on education for sustainable development that was co-created by UNESCO for use in Southern Africa. They're building a program for teacher educators because people like me working with teachers need to have the different approaches and strategies that include transformative learning methods for teacher educators to be able to effectively model these with teachers themselves.
When we drill in a little bit more into the concept of education for sustainable development, we can see the complexity that comes around some of the teacher education. So this is another document published by UNESCO called Issues and Trends in Education for Sustainable Development. And they talk about key competencies that students would need to develop, including things like systems thinking, which we'll talk a little bit more about today, anticipatory competence, which would be a bit like futures thinking. And you can see it goes down the line to things that are around strategic thinking or collaboration, the ability to think critically about the engagement with the content or skills that students are seeing in the classroom or outside the classroom. And none of these in and of themselves, none of these in in and of themselves is specific to the content of global or local issues. These are cross-cutting competencies. Uh-huh. And so the whole point that Elizabeth was just sharing about taking a whole systems approach to teacher education, if we only show teachers methods to kind of teach about particular issues in the classroom, we actually lock the content in time, place, and situation, and we don't enable students to be engaging critically with new situations that may come up or that are relevant for them in their communities. And so it's really important that we're taking that broad systems approach in teacher education itself. So education for sustainable development includes these mental models, the way we look at the world, the way we think about the world, which is all those key competencies that we just saw on the previous slide, the knowledge and understanding about global issues, which of course is important. You know, students needing to understand about the climate crisis will have to understand something about, you know, the nature of the atmosphere and about greenhouse gases and what happens with heat in terms of being trapped in the atmosphere. That is important knowledge and understanding to be able to kind of engage with that global issue. They need particular skills to be able to research, find out solutions, take action, and they also need the dispositions to become compassionate and active citizens. So we've tried to put together a framework that brings down some of these frameworks, which are a little bit more abstract, into something that's quite practical for teachers. It goes back to what Elizabeth was saying, that there is a lot of research on the fact that teachers want to be doing this work with students, and sometimes they get a little bit stuck as to how to do this. So we've called this the Worldwise Learning Framework, and we have a cycle here. And you can see in the middle of the circle, we're centering our curriculum on local, global, and intercultural issues. And those would be things that are relevant for the place, for the developmental age and stage of students, and that would bring together the different curriculum areas, which are already either state or internationally mandated parts of the curriculum. I think in the respect of Finland, this is very similar to a phenomenon-based learning approach, where the phenomenon acts as the glue that brings together the different curriculum areas into a holistic kind of unit of study. And what we want to do in these units is engage students in forming connections through storytelling, through perspective taking, to really feel kind of engaged in that particular issue. We engage them in different strategies to understand the issue. That might be through understanding some of the key components of a particular issue and how it's come about. It might be around seeing the knock-on effects within a system to be able to kind of see where there are root causes that are producing particular outcomes. And then we want students to have opportunities to act, because if we tell students that the only time that they can be active is after they've graduated, we're tacitly giving them kind of the message that they can't enact change. And we know that they can, and they can really be instigating change at the local level, in particular with city governments. What does this look like? Here's an example from kindergarten students, because sometimes we think about local, global, and intercultural issues and assume it's for older students, you know, 15-year-olds or 16-year-olds. Here's an example with a 5-year-old. So in terms of connecting, we went and visited pollinator gardens, finding, you know, caterpillars and chrysalis hanging there and different butterflies, and saw the relationships between some of those organisms in the garden. Then we did some understanding of kind of the systems in habitats, understanding the relationships between different organisms in a habitat, understanding how kind of microsystems like a beehive function with different roles and responsibilities across the different colony, understanding the role between the pollination that bees do and our food system, and then providing opportunities to act locally, such as providing opportunities for them to collect some chrysalis and put them into butterfly gardens to make sure that those butterflies can actually become adults, go out of the butterfly garden and be able to reproduce and, you know, keep that cycle of life continuing. So you can see there how it looks for young children. And what we're trying to do here is provide opportunities where the knowledge, skills, understanding, and dispositions of students are applied, are mobilized in novel or complex situations so that they can develop global competence. And the real goal is that the global competence enables local and global action related to what is meaningful for those students.
So now we'd like to walk you through the three phases of the cycle, beginning with the connect phase. And like ESD, we advocate for a whole child approach, and that means engaging the heart, head, and hand of our learners. This includes activating their prior knowledge and connecting to their experiences, sparking an emotional and intellectual connection, and then widening their awareness of issues. And an effective approach to do so is place-based education. We know that there are numerous benefits of being in nature. And of course, I don't need to tell you that in Finland. That's something I love about Finland is you prioritize time in nature and protecting nature. But it can decrease our stress levels, increase our happiness and our well-being, improve our physical health, and many other positive benefits. Importantly, those who are connected to nature are more likely to feel a sense of environmental responsibility, which leads to pro-environmental behaviors and a greater likelihood of engaging in sustainable practices. We have seen both positive and negative shifts during the pandemic on children's time in nature. Their research internationally has shown a sustained increase in recreational screen time use, which has disrupted sleep and disconnected children more from nature, while others have taken a proactive approach to get children more outside into nature, recognizing the benefits. I want to read a quote from an author we cite in the book, David Sobel, who's written numerous books in environmental education, that he said he wrote in 2019 that before our children are falling asleep with their iPhones or Androids, before they have hordes of Instagram followers, before they are hypnotized by their Netflix accounts, let's saturate them in nature. Let's help them create an environmental identity before they have a social media identity. Let's send them to nature preschool or forest kindergarten. Let's create communities that have a preschool to high school commitment to nature connection. And of course, we advocate to bring this into teacher education as well. So we want to share some stories with you today of teachers who are doing, taking these approaches. And a teacher who has inspired me is Megan Hoekstra, who's in British Columbia in Canada. She's an outdoor educator who believes there is significant value in letting nature be our educator. She wrote that whenever I take my students outside, new questions, new observations, and connections would arise. This led me to be flexible in my lessons and let my students' inquiries shape our learning. So an example is this beautiful tree inquiry in this documentation wall in her classroom. She wrote that trees have always been a subject of interest for me. So when I noticed my class sharing the same passion, I knew I had to act on it. It was time to center ourselves around the significance of the trees and the stories that they have to tell. My class and I journeyed outside most days with the sole purpose to learn and develop a deeper meaning of the natural world. Thus, we became tree detectives, seeking to answer an essential question: what can I learn from the trees? She said that a huge part of learning is grounding yourself and connecting with your senses. We discovered the forest through different perspectives, through the lenses of animals, birds, bugs, and even the trees themselves. We began to think outside the box. How do trees breathe? Can the trees hear us talking? What kind of stories do they share? Do they feel or smell different? What do you notice? I find from an educator's point of view, this urging students through exploring, letting their, I encourage students to explore, letting their natural curiosities guide them. And likewise, as I mentioned, I'm a teacher educator. I am currently teaching a class on play and the creative arts. I'm teaching fully online asynchronously, but I try to bring nature into my online classroom as well. So this is, an example from, these are examples from some of my students in our recent STEAM module on integrating the arts and science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I have students go outside. If I mute it, will it call, will they be able to hear us?
Maybe sorry, just mute that participant, Elizabeth. There you
What's
go.
What's that? Okay. So I also incorporate nature-based learning into my classes, and I wanted to share a few examples. Just a few weeks ago, my students went on listening walks outside, and these are young students who are about 19, 20 years old, and they go on nature hunts, pattern hunts, and other types of nature experiences. I have found that young college students mostly do not engage in this kind of activity out in nature here in the U.S., and students have remarked that the benefits of this, of going outside and being in nature, because I had assigned this as a project, a student wrote that I decided to take a walk with my roommates in the woods behind our apartment on campus. I've never really taken the time to look closely into the trees, leaves, or pine cones in the area. And it was interesting and calming to take a deeper look. I found some patterns in these pine cones and other objects that I would never have seen before had I not gone outside. So this relates to our advocacy for a slow, taking a slow approach and using slow looking. This came out of the art field, but it can be applied in all disciplines. And we, in our book, use it for interdisciplinary planning as a teacher, but also something students can engage in. So slowing down through that slow looking process allows us to locate possibilities, perceive complexities, and design meaningful learning for students. Among the different practices in our book for slow looking is creating inventories where students can look for different categories of objects and curate examples. So we wanted to invite you to do something, an engaging activity is to go on a pattern hunt. So those of you who are in the classroom, you could leave the classroom for 2 minutes and go out into the building and see where you might find examples of pattern. You may want to take a piece of paper, jot down examples. And those of you who are online, of course, in your homes and your space, you could do the same thing where you are located. So we're going to take 2 minutes to go on a pattern hunt to practice this exercise of slow looking. And I'm going to set a timer. So we'll see you back in 2 minutes. Okay, as you make your way back to your seats, these are some example patterns that Carla found when she lived in Singapore. So both natural and human-made patterns. Were these all in your office space or in your some of your home?
Yes. They were all from my office. That's great. I thought to myself, surely I won't be able to find that many patterns because it was just a quite neutral office space. But actually, when you look very closely, you come to realize that it's all around you. And I think that's the purpose of slow looking is to unfold the complexities around us and to recognize that there's much more to be seen than what we typically see. Mm.
So let's share some examples of patterns that you found. Let's take a moment to share maybe two or three. Where did you find some patterns in your space? Would anyone like to share?
I found patterns on the floor, both here, because there is wood. Mm-hmm. And outside on the carpet, there was a pattern too.
Very nice. Other examples? Maybe one more.
Okay, so if we look at the class, even the structure of the class, it's a pattern because we have different rows of tables and chairs, so that will be a huge pattern.
Nice. Thank you. Hey, Carla.
Okay, so we took you through a very short connecting activity. And we talked a bit about the role of nature and I would say immersion in experience to enable students or adults to be able to connect to their local environment and to issues. The next phase is the understand phase of in the Worldwise Learning Cycle. And this is really about developing big picture thinking. And when we say big picture, there's two kinds of thinking that we advocate for, which is the systems thinking and conceptual thinking. So the systems thinking is all about understanding the parts and the relationships that exist within them in any given issue. To be able to recognize leverage points and opportunities for taking action. And you can see an example of that here with the kindergarten unit on pollinators. Here, children took photos of the living and non-living things in the environment and then made relationships between them. So you can see that there's birds that eat caterpillars, and there's also, you know, caterpillars that rely on a host plant, and you have nectar drinking birds competing for resources with the butterflies. And so they're starting to be able to see the relationships that exist just through doing these types of activities. The conceptual thinking is really about making sure that students walk away with big ideas that can be applied to other situations and contexts. So if people there in Finland are thinking about the bark beetle, which I think you also have issues with, just like we do here in Dresden, and they're thinking about the relationship between the bark beetle and deforestation, or the ability of forests to catch fire much more quickly, what do we want them to take away from that? And it's going to be something about the resilience of an ecosystem when there's a change in the number of organisms, individual organisms that, have an impact on the trees. So that would be more of that big thinking. In terms of how this works with teacher education, we wanted to give you a little example. So last year in October, I worked with the University of Ludwigsburg, which is near Stuttgart, and did a seminar on teaching for education for sustainable development with teachers who were in their training to become teachers in various subject areas. And we did lots of different activities. You can see one here where they used current events, and they mapped the current events for things which they saw that were connected in some way. And then they mapped them using these sustainable development cards specifically relating to the goals. So they could start to see how the goals reflect themselves at the local level, and how you can also use the goals to be able to create larger frameworks or umbrellas that you could use with your students. And Anna, one of the students in this class, again, maybe 18 or 19 years old, shared at the end of the seminar, I used to think that you would be very narrowed by the topics you can implement with education for sustainable development. Now I think I can use it in a wide range of subjects and ways that are specific and subject oriented, but with a view into the world just a little wider, so it can open up a new dimension and a new viewpoint for the students and also for me. And I think the important thing here for me is going back to those competences that we saw on the other slide, that we don't need to only focus education for sustainable development on the content of an issue, but it's also about the way that we think and how we're bringing in those ways of thinking to the students in the classroom. So here's another example of what we did together. They actually created systems models using Lego and cork and little pieces of wood and different materials. I actually raided my children's bedrooms and stole a bunch of stuff to use for the seminar. But the divergent materials provided kind of a very creative way of engaging with this, and that you can see they're representing the parts. They're showing relationships between the parts, and they're also showing things like inputs and outputs into the system. So in the rainforest, an input being the carbon dioxide and an output being oxygen, or an input being sunshine and an output being oxygen because of the photosynthesis. And so that they're able to see the complexities that exist through this modeling activity. So when we talk about systems, it's good to have definitions. This is from Donella Meadows. A system is a set of related components that work together in a particular environment to perform whatever functions are required to achieve the system's objective. And often the system will not explicitly share its objective. An ecosystem doesn't say its objective is to maintain balance so that things can live and flourish. It's just the way it is. But when we're analyzing systems, we can think about the objective of that system and look at the parts and the interactions between the parts to be able to see how that objective is met. And in terms of the attributes of complex systems, this is a really nice metaphor to show the difference between a more linear approach to thinking and moving to more of a systems-based approach to thinking. It's about interconnectedness and the relationships that we're seeing between parts to make a complex whole. It's about circular ways of relating instead of linear ways. It's not just A leads to B, but actually A leads to B leads to C, which leads back to A, potentially. It's not about siloed thinking or separate areas. It's actually the interactions that create emergence. So, for example, the bees don't have the idea that they're going to, you know, communicate in a sophisticated way using the angle of the sun to be able to show where there are flowers. However, the relationships that exist within the hive and how they've developed communication over time means that you have the emergence of what's called a hive brain, kind of more sophisticated thinking happening there. And so really it's about those relationships and looking at it through a process of synthesis, bringing together instead of breaking apart. There's lots of tools we can use in the classroom for understanding systems thinking and that systems thinking competence. There's one that we would just like to reference here, which is the Habits of Systems Thinkers. This is from the Water Center for Systems Thinking. And these cards come in a number of different languages. I don't think they're in Finnish yet, but maybe one of you would be willing to collaborate with them on that. But they're really good because they provide particular behaviors that we would want to see from ourselves and from our students. And then on the back of each card, they have some really nice questions, guiding questions that we could be asking our students in relation to the issues that they're exploring. So we're going to focus on one aspect of complex systems, and then you're going to try it out because we've been talking for a while and we want you to have more opportunities for engagement. So we talked about that idea of nonlinearity, that systems are circular, and that we also have emergent behaviors, unexpected behaviors that can emerge. So here is an example with the ants that are actually making a bridge because they're individually kind of connecting. There is no centralized thinking, a head ant, a lead ant that says, okay, everyone, we're making a bridge now. So you go over here and you go over here. Actually, they are all interacting with each other as individual agents with very simple rules, but they're presenting as complex behaviors. And one of the things we can use, you can go to the next slide, Elizabeth, thank you, to try and unpick this a little bit is connected circles. So you can see here an example from grade 7 students that I was teaching in Singapore. And we were learning about belief systems. And we took the example of Stone Age or Iron Age belief systems, basically when it was an animism So believing that the land and animals all had kind of a spirit within them. And so they used a video and had stopping points, and then they had to chart the relationships between different parts of the belief system. And we used this to be able to really understand how belief systems function and the importance of the parts within that belief system in terms of creating a holistic kind of understanding of it. So it helps us see relationships, look at feedback loops. And when we talk about feedback loops, it means something is going to one part and then something's coming back from the other part of the system. So for example, if you were looking at a predator-prey relationship, more fish leads to more sharks, but more sharks leads to fewer fish. And then it creates a balanced loop because of the relationships that go in both directions. So we can use the connected circles tool to find feedback loops and also leverage points, like things that are really important in the system that maybe we want to make a change to get that non-linearity across the system. So you're going to try this out now with the idea of a school system. And so this is not exhaustive. This is not every single part you would have in a school, but it's many. So we have things like external authorities, our students and teachers and our school buildings, our written curriculum, the local environment, legal frameworks. And what you're going to do in small groups, either in the online space, and we'll send you to a breakout room if you are in an online space, or using a physical document if you're in the room, is you're going to make a connection between two parts. And then you're going to write on the line, usually with a verb, how those things are connected. So for example, we might say that the school buildings, and then connect to students, enable learning environments for students. Or we might say that external authorities determine examinations if you've got standardized testing in certain year groups. Okay, so we're going to give you, let's see what time it is. How much time? 10 minutes. We're going to give you 10 minutes for this just to try it out. You will not be done in 10 minutes. I'm telling you, you could go for an hour with this, but it'll give you a sense of what it feels like.
And I'm going to create just one breakout room and open that now. Oops.
We'll just take a chance to hear from one or two people about some of the things you were thinking about or feeling while you were engaging in this strategy. Maybe someone from the room where everyone's sitting in person can be brave and share a connection and something that you were thinking about.
So we have done different relationships, but I would like to underline the relationship that we have put between the legal frameworks and the written curriculum, because we think usually the legal frameworks limits the written curriculum. So them as well, then the written curriculum does not match the thought curriculum, because as well the thought, sorry, curriculum, because teachers as well make modifications due to the limits of the legal frameworks. So I will say that there is like a triangle or like a relationship with where the three of them are influencing each other, and we could also include teachers because teachers have a close relationship with the taught curriculum.
It's a really great connection. It actually is directly what Elizabeth and I were talking about when you were doing your thinking with the strategy. Because in the state where Elizabeth is, they use a scripted curriculum, and it is connected to the political situation in the state. And there are teachers saying, how do we use this in a way where we can actually meet our students' needs? And it's something Elizabeth is trying to support with. And we can see the nonlinear relationships here, how the legal framework affects the written curriculum, affects teachers, and then it affects students at the end of the day. And so it's a really nice relationship that you just shared there. In terms of this strategy, oh, there's another one. This is from the breakout room. You can see just some more examples from our online group. They started to write some relationships on the line. And in terms of how you can use this with students, you can do a few things. You can have like an article that students read. What I have often done to structure it for students is I will create the template with the parts that I want them to connect. And then I'll have stopping points either in a written article or a video, and then ask them in those stopping points to chart relationships, because sometimes it can go so fast that you're hearing about relationships in a video or in a text. There could be a lot in a paragraph. And then you can ask them to kind of critically examine that at the end once they've completed their circle. So now we're going to move on to our last phase, which is the ACT phase.
So in this phase, we want to support students as they develop global citizenship identities by reflecting on themselves and where they might participate meaningfully in decision-making processes and affecting change. This also relates to teachers' development of their own identities, because we want them to assume agency and responsibility in matters of local and global concern as well. This is taking place again throughout. In my state of North Carolina, we revised our professional teaching standards about a decade ago to underscore the importance of developing teachers' global competency. This is in two different standards related to establishing the learning environment to create those conditions where this can occur, as well as understanding the global connections to the content they teach. So regardless of what subject matter, that they can enhance the relevance and make connections to global issues. This statement stands out to me because the policy document states that the different demands of the 21st century, as we opened our workshop with, demand new roles for teachers in their classrooms and their schools. And it states that teachers can no longer cover material. They, along with their students, uncover solutions. They teach existing core content that is revised to include skills like critical thinking, problem solving, and information and communication technology literacy.
So in our book, we try to unpack what we mean by global citizenship, because it's such a huge concept, and what the implications are in the classroom with our students. So we basically say we have three ideas here about global citizenship. One is that global citizens develop global citizenship identities that are really students need to understand what it means to be a citizen. So we want our students to co-construct an understanding of what it means to be a citizen in the classroom, in the school context, in the local context, in addition to that global level. So we don't start with the global, we need to really start with the local. We want our students to value diversity, develop their intercultural understanding, and participate as citizens, as I mentioned, at those various scales. The second idea is that global citizens interrogate and draw connections between systems, structure systems and perspectives that underpin issues, including at different scales. And this connects very much to the systems thinking work that you were just doing in those small groups, because students would be able to draw connections between and across issues at different scales using systems thinking. They would also become knowledgeable about local, national, and global systems and structures, such as how the government works, how the United Nations works, how the climate system works. But then we also want to encourage our students to critically read media for perspectives, biases, and underlying assumptions. And I didn't catch the name because I don't think the person shared it, but the individual right at the beginning that said that one of the implications of having so much content or knowledge being developed is that we don't know what is really reliable information. And so critical reading is a really important skill for citizens of the future. The last idea is that global citizens engage in purposeful, informed action. We want them to collaborate to develop solutions. We want them to address authentic needs. We want them to be self-aware and think about how they can change themselves, you know, where they're purchasing their clothing, if it's made out of polyester, how they're washing those clothes so we don't get microplastics in the water system. And then planning for engaging and reflecting on the impact of their actions. So we just wanted to show you some of the research on this in terms of what students really want. There was a study that happened pre-pandemic, so 2019, with 9,500 young people aged 16 to 25 across 20 countries from the Wise Qatar Foundation. And the research found that 87% of students feel that they have a responsibility to improve the world. So that was really clear. The majority want this. And they had concerns, in particular around poverty and social inequalities, around climate change and access to employment. However, when asked if they felt that they were prepared to take action, only 37% of girls and 48% of boys claim that they are. So we have a mismatch between the sense of responsibility that our students feel and perhaps our education systems, which are not explicitly building the abilities to find solutions to these problems. Another piece of research was done with even more students and more school-age students. So there was a survey done with almost a quarter of a million students in the United States, grades 3 to 12. Only 54% of these students felt that what they were learning in school was relevant to the outside world, which is, you know, not a great kind of percentage to have. We would want that to be much higher. Another survey that was done, I believe, in the European Union, looked at basically the idea of climate change education, and 7 out of 10 students across these 36 countries did not feel that the curriculum allowed them to engage, you know, adequately with the idea of climate change. So we have kind of a mismatch there as well. So we're going to show you one framework that supports global citizenship education through local engagement. And that's the Design for Change model, which comes from Kiran Sethi at the Riverside School in India. There are many Design for Change chapters. Elizabeth works very closely with Design for Change there in North Carolina. I am the Design for Change rep for Germany. There's probably one for Finland. I've met the person who's responsible for Sweden, but not for Finland yet. So it's probably, if you go onto their website, you can see it. And they have a 4-step process, which is feel, imagine, do, and share. We want our students to connect, to be able to really understand what the issues are from the perspectives of those that are involved. We want to imagine solutions without kind of putting parameters or kind of constraints around that, really developing our creative thinking skills. We want to take action, and then we want to share and inspire others in the community. And we're going to show you an example of this from my own school. So this was our submission to the International Schools Awards. We haven't found out yet if we've made it into their finalists or not, but it gives you a sense of how the local citizenship work and the global citizenship work together, and also what this 4-step process looks like in action.
We want to tell you a story, the story of how Design for Change has impacted us as students and our community, allowing us to act as local and global citizens. What is Design for Change?
Design for Change is an approach that brings together design thinking with community engagement, leading to the development of global citizenship, behaviors, and mindsets.
We can and have made positive change to our community. Let us tell you all about it. Once upon a time, there were students who explored their community. That's us. We explored our school, our local neighborhood, our environment further afield.
In our Design for Change co-curricular activity, we walked around the block and toured our school, taking photos of issues that bothered us. We made a list and came up with over 20 things we could change.
In grade 5, we went on 4 trips to local places, a neighborhood near our school, the nearby forest, a food bank, and an elderly home. We recorded issues we observed and formed groups based on ones we want to investigate further.
In this first stage of the process, the field stage, we saw that there are many local places where we can make a difference. Global issues are at our doorsteps here in Dresden. In our co-curricular activity, we decided to focus on our shed. This is a place that should store play equipment, but things have become misplaced, lost, or damaged over time. This issue focuses on the right to play, one of our rights as children.
In grade 5, we looked at many issues, such as accessible building designs for the elderly with dementia, bark beetles in pine forests, and pedestrian safety. Each of these issues connect to the UN Sustainable Development Goals, but are locally rooted, meaning we could easily take purposeful action.
Next, we need to understand these issues deeply.
What perspectives exist about them? Why do they occur? To understand our issues, we interviewed people directly affected by them.
In our co-curricular activity, we decided to interview primary school children playing during after-school care. What kind of play equipment would they like to play with? What suggestions would they make for systems we could use to ensure objects don't get lost in the future?
In grade 5, the group focusing on access for elderly with dementia interviewed the manager of the elderly home, as well as a resident with dementia. The group focusing on pedestrian safety surveyed children at the school about their experiences with the busy road next to our school.
They also gathered information by photographing zebra crossings at other local schools. All of them had them except ours.
Using our research, we used the root cause tree strategy to understand the issue, its symptoms, what we see, hear, or feel, and the underlying root causes, what's causing these to occur. This helped us to see where we could make meaningful change. With all this knowledge and understanding, it was time to move on to the imagine stage. Time to practice our creative thinking and brainstorm possible solutions. Sky's the limit. There are no bad ideas. Here we thought about the best possible future for our issues and came up with as many ideas as we could to move towards it. Using our brainstorm, we then voted on the best idea using the principle of QBL. The idea should have a quick impact, be bold, and be long-lasting. We made sure our actions addressed root causes too. Then it was time to do.
In the do stage, we organized ourselves, devised a plan of action, and undertook our planned action.
Here are some of the things we did.
We ordered play equipment, created an inventory, and developed a system for it in the shed.
We designed paintings and collages for the elderly residents with dementia to support her finding her own room in the elderly home.
We used knowledge about color theory to ensure she could easily recognize it. We planted non-pine trees in local green spaces to restore dead forest, as well as prevent the infestation of bark beetles in the future. We made a pitch to the local traffic authority about why we need a zebra crossing next to our school.
Despite the cost to the city, we are now officially on the list and one will be coming to our school soon. Finally, in the design for change process, we share.
We shared with our school community in various ways. Through teaching others, holding assemblies, and curating mini museums.
But now we share with you.
We share with you to let you know how Design for Change enabled us to act as local and global citizens by starting with our very own community. We know we've made a difference. We have seen it and connected to the Sustainable Development Goals in our actions.
We used to think that global citizenship is something that happens far away. But now we know that there is no global citizenship without local citizenship. Without us doing something to improve where we live, the Sustainable Development Goals can only be achieved globally through actions at the local level, such as the actions we took part in. We hope this inspires other schools to adopt the Design for Change model for a student agency, action, and citizenship. The end.
Hallo, hier ist das Vitana Seniorenzentrum am Sternplatz. Ich bin die Frau Ballasch.
Ich bin die Frau Bonner.
Wir wollen unser Feedback zu dem Projekt mit den Schülern der International School geben und dazu Daumen hoch. Wir haben ganz neugierige, offene, freundliche Schüler kennengelernt, die ganz selbstständig einen Fragebogen erarbeitet haben und diesen Fragebogen bei einer demenziell erkrankten Bewohnerin abgefragt haben. Und dadurch kam es zur Erarbeitung eines Türbildes. Genau. Und weil unsere Bewohnerin früher in ihrem Leben Grundschullehrerin war, verband sie natürlich sehr viele Emotionen mit diesem angefertigten Bild. Und dieses Bild war ein voller Erfolg, hat der Bewohnerin bis heute geholfen, ihre Tür selbst wiederzufinden und sich auf dem Wohnbereich besser zurechtzufinden. Und was ist das Besondere oder was wir auch erfahren oder miterleben durften, ist, dass die Schüler und diese Zusammenarbeit mit der Bewohnerin, das war so emotional und so schön. Und das ist der große Unterschied zwischen Plakaten erstellen oder Geld sammeln, sondern dass es diese Interaktion zwischenmenschlich, das war einfach super. Und dafür
vielen Dank.
Tschüss.
All right. So that gives you an idea of what that looks like, that modeled for Design for Change and the four steps in a school context. And I think you can see here as well, connecting to the model we shared with you, the feel, understand, and act, the role of the connection here, or the connect, understand, and act, the role of the connection in allowing a really meaningful project with the students. And it does connect to the global the sustainable development goals. It is connected to the global level, but it's locally rooted because it's helping that individual in that one care home with her access and reducing the inequalities within that home. But also enabling our students to see how they have a bigger purpose when they're engaging in this local action. So that is one kind of way that we can be developing our students' capacity to understand sustainable development and make actions toward it. And pass over to Elizabeth for this last slide or two.
Okay, so in closing, we have 7 minutes left. We thought we could open it up for a few questions, and then we would like to make a public commitment together on a Padlet. Maybe this session hopefully sparked some ideas that you could take with you into your own context. And we wanted to share what we took away and what next steps we might take. But we have a few minutes if anyone would like to ask any questions before we share the Padlet together. And I'll copy this into the chat for those who are online. Would anyone like to make a statement about something that maybe resonated with them and your roles or what you hope to do in the future with students or teachers that you're nurturing? Perhaps any connections to Finland that you made that you could teach us about?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so my question is just about the competencies that you shared. I couldn't see anything about the technological competence, or I don't know what better word should I use, information technology or something. Is it included already in any of those competencies, or is there a particular reason why that is not included? Because I see that there's a lot of influence of technology and educational technology on education these days. And that's one of the problems that even the parents are worried about, the distraction that it is causing, excessive technological use, things like that. So I was just wondering that where should it fit?
Yeah, it's not explicit in the competencies in terms of being a separate and standalone competence. I think, what's helpful to consider is for young people today, online and offline is just the term on life. So to differentiate between the environment for young people today, because they're moving between digital and physical environments so frequently, it might be best to take a more integrated approach to the development of the competencies across platforms. And so collaboration, of course, is done in person, but just as much, you know, you could be using a Google Docs or, Elizabeth and I, during the pandemic, we used Zoom, collaborated on Zoom a lot, you know, that can actually be online as well. Same with critical thinking. It's the application of the thinking to a context. That context may be online within a educational technology context or with a, you know, a piece of paper that has an article on it. So I think it's more the application and development of the competences through various environments that helps to make them more robust. Elizabeth, do you have anything to add with that?
No, I think that's perfectly stated.
Any other comments or questions people have about some of the ideas we showed today?
I have another question because I found the video with the example from Dresden International School very interesting, but at the same time it made me think like it was a very advanced way and a very academic way of how the children put it. So I would be interested because you said you were involved in the project yourself, right? I would be interested in how you started talking to the children about it. Like, how have you started this project before, for example, they were able to call it global citizenship and point out these different steps? How did you narrow it down for them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a piece around communication and then how we communicate differently with students versus how we might communicate about a project externally in a different way. So when students began the Design for Change process with the Feel, Imagine, Do, and Share, the first thing that they were given as kind of feedback is, we want to look in our local community for things that bother us or places where we think that a change might be necessary. And so the teachers and those were two grade five classes. And then the co-curricular activity that I led was grades 2 to 5. With the grades 2 to 5, we just did like an hour of let's walk around the school. And we're going to take some photos with an iPad of things that bother us. And then we did some sorting of those different photos in another session to say, you know, what really bothers us and where do we think we can make a meaningful change? And they did the same thing with the grade fives, that they went on a walk in the neighborhood. They went to the forest, they went to a food bank, and then they went to the old age home. And there was no kind of push from the teachers about which issue they should or shouldn't take. They started brainstorming things that bothered them from being in those immersive experiences. And then they became more like research projects through the process of narrowing them down into something that could be meaningfully engaged in. So the feel phase, I would say, was not kind of academically structured at all. It was just, let's go and have an emotional response in our neighborhood and see where we can make a change. And as part of that, then they did some research to better understand the issues, whether it be understanding dementia and what happens in the brain, or I took the bark beetle group and they needed to actually understand the life cycle of the beetle. They needed to understand how climate change has led to increased population of beetles. You need to understand what happens to the trees because of the bark beetles. So there was some research that happened, but the first response was much more of an emotional connection to something that they felt passionate about.
Okay, thank you.
And I brought up the Design for Change World website that includes many different examples from throughout the different Design for Change chapters around the world. So you can kind of see what other projects that children have done in their local context. And this is very much scaffolded, as Carla said, you know, it's driven by the students, but it's also the teacher steps in at different moments to scaffold their learning based on what they care about and what they're interested in. So we wanted to, sorry, I'm having trouble with my screen, to invite you to maybe share some takeaways. I'll pull up the tiny URL again because we have it at the hour. Here's a QR code if you have your phone, or you type in the tiny URL just for us to kind of share some next steps together. And I'll pull up the website, the Padlet. But it's been a pleasure to spend this last 90 minutes together with you. We're happy to share any resources with you if you'd like to reach out to us. Our email addresses, I believe, are on the house space. We'll add them if they aren't. So you could contact us directly, and we would love to partner together on this work. So thank you so much. Any last words, Carla?
No, just thank you so much. I mean, one thing I will say is that if people are really interested in the Design for Change model, some of the European partners and I have put in a Erasmus Plus grant request to be able to do teacher education around entrepreneurial thinking, systems thinking, design thinking, and to use some of the materials from Design for Change. And maybe I can pass it on to the university there. If we get the grant, then we will have some opportunities for people to be coming to workshops fully funded by the EU next academic year.
Hey, thank you so much. Would love to see your thoughts on the Padlet, if you don't mind adding some takeaways or next steps for us today. Mm-hmm. But thank you for participating, and we hope you have a wonderful rest of the seminar.
Yeah, thank you so much.